This is the Ben Ryan Podcast.
Now, for today's show, I welcome Olympic silver medalist and England and Team GB Rugby Sevens captain at both the Rio and Tokyo Olympic Games, Tom Mitchell. Now, we decided to make the most of the sun shining when we met up in Richmond Park in southwest London, so decided to walk and talk through the fields, bracken, and occasionally muddy paths. It really was a great conversation, and having originally given Tom his international debut when I coached him with England, we had well over a decade of collective experiences to unravel and explore together. He talks about his return from the Tokyo Olympics, missing out on a medal after claiming silver in Rio, injuries, disappointments, and much, much more. We really get stuck into his leadership and the style he prefers, both giving and receiving, as well as the tools he uses to stay present and be as authentic as he can. We start with me asking why he posted a series of stories on his social media around the theme of mindfulness.
I think I was looking to do something that was a little bit different and actually put something out into the world that was a bit different, because obviously a lot of my Instagram, for anyone who follows me, is rugby, because that's a lot of what I do. But I think I'd also had a big, I'd lent into some of those mindful sort of practices quite a lot, particularly in the last year, and found them really beneficial. And it's been, you know, it's an education for me and a journey for me in terms of understanding what benefits me. And, you know, with the challenges we've faced over lockdown and various things that have been going on in my life, I thought, well, why not try and share some of these things? And I'm also, I suppose, conscious of some of my following are quite young, you know, young rugby fans, I guess, in a lot of cases. But it's not necessarily a narrative that's attached that commonly with rugby players. And the kind of, it's much more popular than it used to be, but the approach of mindfulness and what that brings with it, and kind of tying that in with rugby or rugby players and that group of people, I thought was something that's probably useful. And my approach with anything like that now, and I used to shy away from doing things publicly, and I probably still do have a little bit of a reluctance to put stuff out in the world unless I'm dead certain that it's really valuable and useful. But I think now I'm much more willing to just, if I think something's benefited me and it could benefit even one other person, I'm more willing to put it out there. And that was the case with that stuff.
And do you still use those routines regularly now as part of your daily timetable?
Yeah, I mean, a lesson I learned with a lot of that stuff when I first started picking up, I guess, tips or methods or habits, and you read about it and you bring in from various sources and you hear about people who do things daily, it actually was a bit counterproductive, because when you know or you hear these things are good for you and when you recognize they're good for your own well-being, you can then have a tendency to put a bit of pressure on yourself to do them regularly. And actually that's why the sort of habits as a label is not that useful, because I think it doesn't allow for the kind of flexibility or the ultimate intention, which is to make, it's the approach to life in general. So it's not necessary, you don't have to be mindful by sitting down and meditating. You can be mindful when you're eating your food or having a conversation with someone. And I think that's the important approach to kind of garner by doing these things. Interestingly, you've caught me at a time where I've really neglected those things, and I don't know why that is, but the sort of fallout from the Tokyo Olympics and some of the disappointment, and I think the natural come down that I experience, oh, I say it's natural for me, I think. I have a come down after tournaments when it's probably the most important time to kind of go into those things, that activities or approaches that I know benefit me. But actually, I haven't done that at all in the last couple of weeks since we've been back. And I think there's a little bit of, probably at the risk of getting too deep too soon, a little bit of sort of subconscious, sort of self-destructive nature, or a kind of relishing in the things that aren't that good for me or aren't going to necessarily benefit me, if that makes sense. I think that's a reaction to doing something for a long time in terms of an approach to the games that was forcing me to be on it. And you do have to kind of do things that are good for you and benefit you. Does that make any sense?
It does make sense. I would love to kind of backpedal a little bit, because for some of the listeners, they'd be intrigued, and so would I, into what a come down looks like. Is it a physical one, a mental one?
I think those, in terms of the physical and the mental, they obviously both come together, because you know what a sevens tournament is like. A huge range of emotions that you go through. You get a huge dose of adrenaline over the course of the weekend. You get physical exhaustion as a result of it. You have an outcome which stirs up various emotions depending on which, how you finish. So I think all that combined means that you then, and the other thing is you spend a lot of time with a group of people, and when you come back you're no longer with those group of people, you're not in that exciting environment necessarily. So there's quite a stark departure from something that you've had. And so I think it's that, it's a sort of flatness. It's also, you also add into the mix a bit of jet lag. So yeah, so I've always had these lulls when I've come back. And actually, when I was younger, I probably didn't tell you this when you were the coach, I used to like really want to indulge in those few days we were back before we were then back in training. And by indulging, I mean things that aren't very traditionally very good for you. So like either going out or just like consciously eating badly, because you sort of almost to reset yourself. But it's not a good, it wasn't a useful strategy, because then you just have to, you're in a worse place when you pick it up again. And I think that approach, well, in terms of professional sport, but actually for everyone, understanding this kind of sliding scale of being on and being off. And I think it is more of a sliding scale rather than a switch. And I think I've probably, in when I was a bit younger, and things when I was at tournaments were probably a little bit more intense for me. And I needed to then respond by being even more off and indulging some of those less, I say less healthy behaviours. Whereas normally now, or in recent years, I think I've probably been a bit steadier throughout the whole experience, whether that was being away or being back. As a result of being a bit more steady in recent years, I think it kind of took me a bit by surprise, the level of kind of come down off Tokyo.
That was going to be my opening question really to you. Having let the dust settle on Tokyo, what are your thoughts now?
Funnily enough, when I was driving up, I was just listening to some music and enjoying myself, and I was just sort of noticed that I probably only really starting to feel the kind of peace again that I sort of seek to live with. And so the last 2 weeks have been ones of sort of kind of full of emotion and a lack of like understanding, or a lack of kind of clarity and ability to, an inability rather, to really understand the experience and what it meant for me and what it was. And obviously listening to a couple of your previous episodes, particularly one with Kath about
the long win
was useful, I'll be honest, in this particular period of my life. But the confusing thing for me in a way coming back was, and I say it took me by surprise, I think it's because I felt I had such a strong perspective, and I think I still do, about this journey, this Olympic journey, and particularly for us as a GB program, was always going to be about more than whatever place we finished. But I think because I'd held on to that, and that was such a guiding principle for me and such a big part of our narrative, I probably didn't prepare myself for the invariable emotional disappointment that came with still falling short of what we wanted.
One of the previous podcasts was with Owen Eastwood, who wrote the book Belonging, and we talked about exits. So when people leave programs, when people are dropped, again, that's really given not enough volume in prioritizing that, and yeah, it's a huge part of your culture. And it's the same, like, people, athletes, don't ever think about post-event, and no one's there to, was anyone there to guide you on that, or are you just using your experience to unpack what's going on right now?
Yeah, I absolutely, just using my own experience and trying to, the difficulty was, in practical terms, we had 2 days post-tournament to spend together as a group.
Because the rules were that you allowed, what, 48 hours in
I think
village?
So, and then you're flying out.
The program, yeah.
Which, you know, makes a lot of sense, but we didn't have a minor interlude while we walked for a quagmire.
Yeah,
you've got white trainers on as well.
That's pretty much 99% of my wardrobe is white trainers, but I also have a very good washing machine.
They're not white anymore.
Tom, I'm really sorry about this. As we creep our way through the bull rushes.
Oh, I love this. This
and
is...
there's some... Yeah, we're crossing over into a slightly different hybrid of a podcast here, because I could talk to you about
this
some of
gonna catch on.
The deer droppings that we've seen as well. But we're traversed across now.
We're going this way. So, yeah, the practical side of it was we didn't have a lot of time together to kind of sit down and really unpack it in a way that would be useful. But it's something I definitely identified because, well, my fear really was not for myself, but I was thinking about the guys who are going to end up, and I'm sort of taking myself out of it for now for Paris, but let's assume I'm not there. For the guys who are going to take it forward to Paris, it's really important that they unpack this experience from a performance point of view. Now, obviously, primary to that is it's really important we unpack this experience from a human point of view, where it fits into our stories as people and as a group, because it's been such a powerful journey. And with the abrupt end, you do lose something. You not only lose something from the ability to process it as a person, but the strength of what we experience as a collective as well does get lost in some ways. What struck me as soon as the Olympics became the thing for me and for a lot of the sport, there's a huge emphasis on it. And you have to, I think there's an important reason there's an emphasis on it, because it's the biggest sporting event in the world and it's an incredibly prestigious event to compete at. But because that only happens every 4 years, it's a really potentially dangerous focus to rely on too heavily. I think holding it quite lightly is really, really valuable, and reflecting on some of the stuff we've talked about already. But seeing that Olympic journey is where the value lies, and it's much easier to say it in now and while we're in a sort of comfortable headspace, but that's where that's the truth of it. Because there are so many things that are out of your control about the actual Olympics as an event. I mean, last year was a classic case in point, where suddenly all this we'd worked towards was being, well, we thought at one point just cancelled completely. You know, we were relieved that it was only postponed by a year. But even then, we didn't know it was going to go ahead. But it's a difficult thing to kind of speak about in some ways, because I feel a bit conflicted about it. Because whilst it's an amazing thing to be a part of, and you grow up with these dreams, you know, we grow up watching the Olympics and have this thing deep inside us that makes us want to be a part of it. And a lot of the things that it stands for are amazing. I'm only really now probably truly locating where the value sits in being part of it. And it is a lot more to do with the journey and the opportunity to be in that cycle, whether you achieve what you want at the games or even whether you actually end up competing at the games. But if you're in the bubble of competing to be an Olympian, it offers you huge challenge and huge opportunity.
But as for your day-to-day, I imagine, you know, particularly in the last 2 years where, you know, you were lottery funded, did it put into stark reality like the choices you had made as an athlete to follow your dreams against beginning the next chapter of your life?
There have been various stages throughout my playing career where you sort of sit back and you assess whether you want to continue along this path or try and diverge off and do a different one. And there are kind of, I guess, a couple of things that I've always checked in with myself to make sure that I'm on the right path. And I suspect there are people that do this and either continue or diverge off and retire and do a different career. But there are probably also people who never check in with themselves. And then whether they go on to win a gold medal at Olympics or not, they probably end up a little, potentially, they're running the risk of being disappointed. And I guess the things I sort of tend to check in on are, do I love what I'm doing? Am I as passionate about the sport as I was when I started? And the answer to that has always been yes. And if there's definitely been times when I've, because a lot of my mates from university went into the city and earning loads of money and whatever, and I've always been comfortable doing rugby and been very fortunate that that's been the case. But I've also asked myself, like, actually, am I living the lifestyle I want? You know, and do I want to earn more money doing other things? And that almost comes back to the first question, which actually, I'm loving the life I'm living and I love playing the sport. So that trumps the second question. So I think that, yeah, those check-ins are really important. Funny enough, it's reminding me of a time after Rio, which I loved. And I thought that was definitely one of the highlights of my career. Loved being a part of it. Generally, the feeling coming out the back of it was one of massive excitement and satisfaction, even though we didn't win gold. But for us, winning silver was a massive achievement and I think probably went beyond what we were expecting. And we went to the it wasn't that long a break before going in for pre-season again and then the World Series starting up again. And we won in Cape Town in December that year.
Yeah, I was there. I was there.
And it was an unbelievable game. And then the anthems at the start were brilliant. And I love the game. But then at the end, and we were getting our medals, and it's the first time we'd won a tournament for a long time, for most of us. And I was like, oh no, this doesn't feel as good as Rio. Oh no. And I was like, oh no, I've peaked.
Genuinely didn't.
Yeah, and I just didn't feel that emotional high. I mean, Rio was such an emotional high because of everything that went into it and lots of circumstances, but it just didn't quite live up to that. I mean, there were loads of reasons for it looking back. Like, we probably hadn't had enough time to just chill and step away. We probably continued into the season maybe too quickly in some ways. But also, like, trying to compare a World Series event to a whole Olympic Games, which is probably not fair. And I was kind of a bit rocked by this thing. And I went back and Simon Amor was the coach. And I remember going back that Christmas and having a conversation with him about whether I should retire. And I was confused. I was kind of said to him, like, I'm worried that I'm not going to feel the enjoyment that I need to justify kind of continuing in the game, because I do it because I love it. And if winning tournaments is going to leave me feeling a little bit flat, then where do I go? And I think he sort of smiled, because I think he could see there were other reasons for this and that it probably wasn't the best time for me to retire. And I'm glad that that was the conclusion we came to. And actually, that same season, we went a couple of months later and won in Vancouver. And that was total elation. And I felt amazing. And I had none of that sense of flatness. And I guess it's kind of brought back a couple of things, was that you can be, your emotions can kind of play in a way that you're not always aware of, and to make decisions on your life. But like, I could have jacked it all in then and sort of panicked and said, no, I'm done. It was just an interesting moment. Can't even remember how we got to that, why I brought that up.
Just talking about the journey as a funded Olympic athlete, and you know, there's the motivation around that, the opportunity to perhaps do something else, to stick at it when it gets tough, when you know that funding disappears, when the Olympic Games was at risk of not even happening, and suddenly your mindset changes. And then also perhaps the cycle, getting involved in a program for such a long time that there is an element of it burning you out mentally as much as physically.
Yeah, I sort of remember joking about burning out at some point every season, which I was probably partly me exaggerating the experience, but was probably also a sign that there's probably something in it, you know, no smoke without fire a little bit. And I think sevens, I don't know, I've never been in any other sport, but I think sevens does draw a lot out of you, demands a lot from you physically and emotionally across the season. And actually, in some ways, no more so than in the last year, because it was, and not in the way that I was enjoying that much for the last year either. Like, there's a strange satisfaction of draining yourself physically and emotionally at tournaments and being part of the season. But there wasn't much enjoyment from draining myself with the stress and anxiety about whether they were going to have a program, whether there was going to be a future for sevens in this country, whether I was going to be able to make a living from doing the sport anymore, whether I needed to move on to a different career. Those thoughts weren't enjoyable in any way, to be honest.
The Dutch Olympic team, for their rowing team, has been really successful in the last few years. And one of the things that they offer a lot of their athletes, just as we hear a hedge being trimmed in the background, very expertly done, actually, it looks like. They offer a gap year often in the cycle, so that they fund them, but say, look, take a year out, switch off from the sport. It's a little bit counterproductive, because often those athletes are in, you know, peak fitness and in their mid-20s, and, you know, you'll often be told by someone old and supposedly wise like me, like, you never, you know, you're retired for a long time and enjoy it where you can. But it kind of allows them to just press a little reset, remind them on how great the opportunities are that they've got, and they come back firing and overperforming.
I've had exactly this thought. Around that same time when I was questioning whether I should stop, I had that exact thought. So actually, maybe I'll just have a break, and I love traveling, and maybe I'll just go traveling for a bit and then come back to it. But then exactly that fear you've described is, well, hang on, I've only got this many years to play the sport, because physically there's a time limit. Also, there's no guarantees that there'll be anything for you when you come back. I mean, it's different in that Dutch model, if they're offering that with a guarantee at the end of it, it's a very different prospect.
Would you have enjoyed that?
Well, I think I'd like to think I would have had the courage to do it, even if I had no guarantee of a contract coming back. But wanting to savour the time I had to play the game trumped my desire to leave the game still. So really, I wasn't in a place where I needed to leave or even wanted to leave to the extent that I was willing to sacrifice a year's playing because of the opportunities that, you know, we know come from being involved every year. It's amazing. But that approach, I think, is there's a lot to be said for it. I mean, it's something that I think we were quite open to with England, and there were quite a few, especially the younger players, is more education and studying, but there was at least an acceptance, if not in some ways positively encouraged, to go and do other things alongside. But I found that more difficult as my career has gone on, and I don't really know why. I think the more you occupy yourself with the team, and the more you feel part of the direction of travel of a group, and not just the rugby side of things, but, you know, direction of the program, the direction of the sport in this country. And I'm not saying I've influenced that in any way, really, but once you feel connected to that, it occupies more of your time, more of your headspace, and more of your thinking. And so you suddenly don't feel like you've got that much room for anything else. And interestingly, when I first started, when you were coaching, one of the biggest things I reflect on that was of benefit was that I was still at uni. And I was actually still studying, albeit not doing a huge amount of it, but I still had a big focus away from the rugby. Because I think if I hadn't had that, being on the World Series and training and playing with England Sevens would have been so overwhelming. And especially if we'd been, because kind of back then we were full-time, but it was more of a camp-based thing. So I was going back to my uni house every week for a few days, which I think really softened the impact in a good way, because otherwise it would have been a bit too much, perhaps.
That's the juxtaposition that I see a lot in modern elite sport now. And luckily, I think in professional rugby, that's now been far more welcomed if an athlete or player has gone, do you know what, I'm in my days off and my time away, I'm going to set up a coffee business, or I'm going to do some further study, or I'm going to take up a hobby. And 10 years ago, that coach might have said, why aren't you concentrating on rugby, living and breathing it? And actually, the answer now is, yeah, we want you to do this sort of stuff because I think it will make you a better player.
I actually don't think that's filtered through to the players necessarily, in my experience, because there's still that fear among some players that their playing will drop off, their quality will drop off. And you still hear some players are like, oh, yeah, this year I'm just going to focus on rugby. And like, there's alarm bells when you hear that, because, well, focus on what does that mean? Like, it's difficult to conceptualize, and it's different for every individual. But in my experience, whenever I've had something else going on, it's served me pretty well, and it's actually allowed my performance to improve, if anything.
If I go back to Tokyo, for me, I mentioned it on social media at the time. There were the highs and lows for you were encapsulated in a few minutes, really, in the quarterfinal game, early on, where you got an injury, just on the deep in your 22, and you got taken off, and you couldn't return to the field of play. There's different timelines here. There's that immediate feeling when you're going in and getting an injury, and what your thoughts are. Then there's going off and watching the team win the quarterfinal. But for me, one of the best examples of leadership I've seen from a captain was when you weren't playing, but you were still talking to them at half time in that semi-final.
It was in
the quarter-final in that game where you had to. Well, you tell me what you had to do, because I think a lot of people would have struggled to have been as clear thinking, as purposeful, and showing those clear signs of leadership that you did in those moments. Do you mind kind of, for the listeners, just going through perhaps that timeline when you received the ball and you got your injury to the end of your tournament?
Yeah, I mean, firstly, like, I am glad you've brought this up, because this also encapsulates a bit of a kind of what we touched upon, that 14 minutes and the ups and downs, which I'll go through in a minute, is something that I'm probably one of the proudest things about this whole journey, because it was a sign of me being able to live out a lot of things I've worked on, a lot of them to do with, you know, me being able to be myself, and also some of the kind of emotional agility, which is a phrase I know a lot of people use now, but to be able to use that in a moment that really mattered for other people. But interestingly, I can't really channel the satisfaction of what that signified for me in terms of the work for the last 4 or 5 years, because it's still a little bit clouded with the emotions. And I would just say that I think it's okay for that to be the case for now, because the satisfaction I've got from knowing that that's personal development that's really meaningful will be there for a long time, whereas the emotions will subside very quickly and already are. But yeah, so obviously anyone who's been in a quarterfinal Olympic Games, or any tournament at any level really, you know, it's an exciting chance to first have your knockout games of the tournament. And that's where you go into it with an extra bit of buzz probably than what you've had in the group games potentially.
Any fear there that if you win, you're into medal matches, if you lose, 4 years, 5 years work has, yeah, from medal point of view, it's disappeared?
I think there's always a tinge of that fear that's wrapped up with the excitement, right? Like those two things often walk the path hand in hand, and it's just being able to, you know, lean into one more so than the other. I'm not sure they're ever completely separate, but there was certainly the feeling of more of excitement. It was a really interesting matchup actually with USA specifically, because we'd played them in the build-up more so than anyone else, just by circumstance of them traveling to more tournaments and or the same tournaments as we did. So as teams, we sort of knew each other inside out, and we knew that. We knew exactly what they offered, and we knew how to beat them. So there was, I guess, taking a certain confidence from that, which helped us channel the excitement more than the fear, perhaps. But very early on, the kind of what I was very excited about had quite a significant bump in the road, insofar as I got in a tackle, sort of thought, oh, that felt a bit awkward. That doesn't feel quite right. Stood up, thought I was going to be fine. Physio was right there just checking me over. I thought, oh, I'm okay here. And then turned out some of the neural firing to some of the muscles in my leg was just completely shut off, and I could barely walk, let alone run. Massive sense of denial, firstly, when you're in that situation, because you recognize how big this game is, how big the moment is for you. And so it's difficult to channel the objective thinking required. And a couple of the boys who were obviously thinking a bit more clearly than I was like, Mitch, you should go off because you can always come back on. And they were sort of seeing that I wasn't in a space to carry on in that moment. Anyway, so I went off, and actually for the majority of that first half, at least for the next sort of 2 or 3 minutes, I was thinking about whether I was going to be all right to come back on. And I was trying to test it, and I was trying to feel it out and go for a little trot down the sideline. And I don't know if they captured any of that on the camera, but it was probably obvious to everyone that I wasn't going to be coming back on. And then there was that realization probably a minute or so before the half, and I could feel the tears come into my eyes, thinking not only is this game over for me and we're losing, so this might be, it kind of all happened at once, but also probably deep down knowing that that was the end of my tournament, even if we did progress. So I had a very quick moment where I turned away from the bench and just sort of looked up. Fortunately, no one in the crowd to see this, but I like really to gather myself, because I thought I'm going to lose it here, because it just sort of all came up. I felt the tears come into my eyes. I thought, actually, this is not a useful thing for everyone else right now. And I think this is what I mean about being proud about that moment for myself, in that I was able to acknowledge how I was feeling about that very quickly and kind of move on. And actually, I think it was actually Sergio Parise was talking once, and he spoke about behaving in a way for your team, even if that's not how you're feeling. And I remember thinking, well, that's not authenticity. And then I realized actually the authentic thing to do is to channel whatever your beliefs are in that moment, regardless of what your emotions are telling you, because there's different things. And what I was able to do in that moment was kind of put my emotions, which were partly bogged down in my own desire to want to play, desire to want to achieve stuff for myself, put those to one side and channel something which was actually more important for me, which was doing the right thing for the team in that moment. And it was actually Rocky, who's our coach, Tony Roakes, was very composed in that moment, which was not an easy thing to do considering we were 21-7 down, I think, at halftime. Definitely the second best team in that first half. And he kind of what we tended to do was allocate roles to some to the subs. So one of the subs would deliver a message on attack, one would deliver a message on defence, and one on kickoffs. There wasn't a huge amount from a tactical point of view. They'd already made some adaptations on the pitch at that point. It was more of a, as anyone knows, you talked about the excitement-fear dynamic. Yeah. When you're losing in a game, all of a sudden that game's halfway through already, the balance can start to shift towards the fear a little bit more because you can see how this might play out and it's not looking good. And I think that was the aim when I went on at half-time, was to provide some perspective. It's not really reassurance, because I think when people try and, or at least the way I interpret reassurance a lot of the time, is there's something wrong, so we need to be reassured. And it was really just trying to deliver some of the realities for the boys at that moment. And those realities were that, you know, we were a good enough team to win it and we needed to trust that. And they'd already done some, made some changes which were really working, and we just needed to stick with it. And it wasn't, you know, it's not rocket science, it's not groundbreaking stuff. And I wanted to deliver it in a way that I guess took the heat out of the situation to some extent as well.
Yeah, it was uplifting as well, actually. You know, you delivered it in a clear and relaxed manner. They were expecting you probably to be quite emotional at that moment. And I use this all the time, but your confidence in your message made them think that they then were very competent in the moment.
Hmm.
So it was layered. It's that subconscious that they would have thought, hold on, he's very measured here. He's really confident in us.
And I think that was, when going back to the sort of emotional agility thing and being authentic in those moments of being agile with how you behave as a leader or as part of a group. I wasn't channeling anything in that moment that wasn't real for me or I didn't believe in. I might not have been feeling all of those things up to that moment, or, you know, I might have been feeling other things as well, or other things more strongly. But I was relaying truths that I believed in, you know, and that a lot of those had been embedded a long time before that moment, obviously. And it was a case of just being able to draw them out and channel them and deliver them in a way that reflected those beliefs. So, you know, when I'm talking to the group about being excited about what's to come, which I often do before a game, you know, I look excited and I smile and I'm, you know, almost like laughing, because that's what you do when you're excited about something. And it's not manufactured, it's just allowing that to happen. And I think, to sort of broaden this out a little bit in terms of my own journey, the biggest lesson I've learned in my ability to lead people is it's much more about allowing it to happen rather than doing it or forcing it. And I think that was a good example of that, where it wasn't about, you know, turning it on or anything, it was just about allowing some of that to come through.
That's a good moment to pause and think a little bit about how you see leadership, either being led by someone, how you feel, what sort of leaders do you want to be around, and what sort of leader do you think you are now?
Yeah, I don't know if this is legit because it's your podcast, but can I swing it back on you, bearing in mind our journey together?
Sure.
Back in the early days of my career, you were the first person to appoint me captain of the England team. It was at the European tournament in Lyon. And I am interested, what was, in those early days, were there characteristics or traits that you thought were important? And if there were then, are those still things you think are important now?
It's a good question. I think I haven't changed in the values that I'd like, ideally, in a leader, but circumstances and environment and where that team is in a certain moment sometimes requires a change in that type of leader. So, yeah, when you came on board and fairly new into the system, and then you've got to be established as a starter. You know, for me, I think that's very important, that the leader has to be respected for what they do on the field and the values that they bring on the field. You know, that, so I could see that you were always willing to empty the tank and give it everything you've got. I also, perhaps the way we wanted to play and the philosophy, you were willing to be attack-minded. And I like that in a leader, to think forward and not be conservative. And another important trait that I value a lot in captaincies and in leaders is having a consistency, a level approach to things. That, yep, I'm sure there's moments where ego can get front of house a little bit more. But generally, I thought you led by being consistent, and everyone therefore, as a result of that, can trust you. And trust is important for a leader. We go back to one of the things you said about 20 minutes ago, when you're saying, I wasn't sure whether I could have told you some of the stuff earlier in the career. That then means for me that we didn't have a safe enough relationship for whatever level. It might be that you felt you were new to the program and didn't want to say anything, but I think that's really important that you can have a safe relationship so that everything's out in the open. So I guess key things for me kind of would be that consistency. You've got to be able to do your trade and be selected, and then what you do on the field has got to be the right values that support what sort of program you want.
I think where I have tried to develop is recognize those things as being valuable and then try and understand how I can live that out over the course of a 9-10 year career. So in answer to your question of what is important to me as a leader, I suppose the first thing I'll go for is a couple of the values that I try and live by and lead by. And those would be things like love, curiosity. And I feel like you can't go far wrong if you're using those things as your guiding principles. Now, what is, it sounds very simple when we're walking around peaceful Richmond Park, and it's easy to talk about, you know, being loving and being curious as a leader. But actually put that into context of a rugby team with, you know, an age span of 18 to 30, whatever. It's not always that straightforward, and actually understanding in each context how to apply those principles is much more of a nuanced and interesting challenge. One I've got, almost certainly got right and got wrong on occasions. So, but those are probably my guiding principles. And I think there was a sticky period in the middle of my career, not that it affected my ability to perform on the pitch that much, but in terms of my leadership, where I was trying to develop myself into a top leader, whatever that is. And I was probably doing that in the wrong way by trying to emulate other people or try and draw out characteristics that I thought were appropriate of a top leader that I didn't really possess, rather than actually just tapping into what I already had as strengths, what I really already believed in, understanding that those are my beliefs, and then kind of applying those to a context and being brave about that.
How did you get to that point then? Because it happens all the time for leaders. They'll read some books, they'll think what they think needs to be said and needs to be done, and then it will take them some time to actually realise that staying true to yourself and your own values and everything else, that's what will shine your light brighter.
Yeah.
How did you get to that point? Because some leaders never get to that point.
Well, I love that phrase, shine your light brighter, and actually a phrase that's similar to that I used as a guide in the end was being all of myself in the world. And you kind of, it is funny, it's exactly as you described it. You have to, if you go through the process, you almost feel like you've gone backwards before you then are able to become more of yourself in that leadership role. And I think I did do that. I really grappled with this sense of trying to do the right thing, and my intentions were in the right place, as in, you know, I was trying to grow and I was trying to be better, but I was just misdirecting some of that effort. The signs were there, as in I wasn't really enjoying, I found it really challenging. And I guess I sort of processed that as that part of the experience was that because I was challenged, it allowed me to come out the other side in a better place. But whether I could have dodged some of that, suffering is not the right word, but whether I could have dodged some of that emotional turmoil, you know, I don't know. You never know.
But wouldn't it have, you could say the counter argument is that you have to go through some disappointment, some missed shots, to then find the best version of yourself. It's kind of that combination of experience and ability to get where you want to. I was going to just ask a question then. One of the teams that I'm involved in at the moment is really young, and they're playing professional team sport, and the leaders are young, and they've got the beginning of their journeys. And one of them said to me, you know, what do you think's important to a leader? How can I become a better leader? How would you answer that question?
My first thing I'd do to probably provide some clarity would be to establish that we're not going to allow the on-pitch performance and the sort of day job to suffer too much as a result. Yes, we might spend more time and energy on the leadership in the short term, but try and kind of settle some of those fears that might come of losing the ability to just do the day job, you know. So that would be the first thing. And then the second one, I wouldn't even start by trying to give any like advice about how to lead or anything like that. I think the focus, particularly for young leaders, is how can we help them understand themselves, understand why they think a certain way in certain situations. And the more you can feel equipped with that and actually understand the way your own mind works, you can then start to adapt certain bits of behavior if appropriate. But you're kind of getting them off on the right foot in terms of equipping them to do the job, because it's not about, I don't think leadership is anything other than understanding how you are as a person and how you have a tendency to behave, combining that with how the rest of your team likes to behave in certain situations, and then drawing the connections accordingly. And maybe as a sort of practical first step, I would encourage, this is an exercise that I went through, was to kind of write a bit of a statement about what kind of leader you want to be, because that will give you some information. And I think it's important to try and encourage that process to be done based on what you think is important as a person, rather than framing it as like, you know, write down what you think a good leader looks like objectively, because you get two very different things. So yeah, that would be my starting point. I mean, the big thing for me, to go back to my own story, was during that period where I was trying to improve my leadership, because that was I felt like that was my thing. You know, that was my big role in the team, was to try and guide and to try and develop and help people be the best they could be. That period was a period where I really gained huge understanding about myself as a person, ended up doing quite an extensive kind of psychological dive into why I was the way I was, why my brain worked a certain way. And a lot of that was, you know, we did even go into some upbringing, and it was really interesting. Like, again, a challenging process, but really interesting. And I came out, come out the back of it, makes it sound like you go through a process and you arrive. That's not the way, because I'm still learning, developing, understanding now. But it was really powerful. And that was a huge, it was a turning point, I think, in my ability to explore myself as a leader and become more of myself in that role within the team.
Have you come across any examples when you've been a leader where you've talked about how you've spent time investing in yourself to try to find out more about yourself, the mechanics of how you think, what's important to you, all of those angles to get you better at what you do? Have you ever been led by or led someone where you're really finding it hard to unlock them?
Yeah, and this really doesn't sit very well with me, because my sort of bias, I suppose, what I'll always be drawn towards are deep connections with other people and very powerful relationships. I like to connect with people on quite a deep level. And that the reality of life is that isn't always possible. And some people are in a rugby environment where they do see it as more of a day job. Like, especially some of the young guys have never put thought into actually rugby being about relationships. Rugby is about playing on the field for them. So yeah, that's happened all the time. And I find it very frustrating, because even after I've spent a good number of years with certain people, I do beat myself up about it a little bit. That's just my tendency, the way I sort of react, because I feel like I've fallen short in my role then. But I think a lot, you just have to accept that.
Because you want to find a key for everybody.
Yeah,
to try to help them become at their best.
That's exactly it. A key, yeah, that's a great metaphor.
What do you do when you just, we always want to, and sometimes really find it the most challenging in a good way, to unlock those people that you just struggle with? What happens when you can't do it?
I guess the way I've reacted to that is to try and be at peace with that and understand that you can still have an impact. It just might not be on the level that you want it to. I mean, the nature of, I guess, the way I operate and the way I see leadership is that the ideal for me will be, right, every single person in the team, I'm going to inspire them way beyond rugby, and I'm going to help them grow into the person that they are meant to be, in inverted commas, which is obviously an unrealistic aim. I mean, I don't think it's a problem to have that as an aim. I think it kind of serves me in a lot of ways. But I think I've learned to just be at peace with when that doesn't come to fruition. What I will say, though, is I do also reflect on some of those cases and think, I actually wish I'd created more a different space, or probably put a bit more time into that. Because there's also a bit of me over the years that has had a probably, you know, sometimes conscious, sometimes subconscious aversion to people who are different from myself, knowing that actually to get that deep level connection is going to be uncomfortable for me as well as it's going to be uncomfortable for them. And I don't want to put either of us in that space.
But what a great learning opportunity.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, the regret thing, but as a principle, but I'd like to kind of go back and just see if I'd explored relationships with people in a bit of a different way, or being a bit braver perhaps, you know, where that would have gone. Might not have made a difference, but I'd like to have just, and I will take that forward now into sort of future groups, future teams, and I have taken that forward, I think, in the kind of recent, well, certainly in the last year or so.
Joe DeSena talked about in one of the episodes that we you know, our natural instinct is to make choices that make us comfortable. Mm. And you know, he does the opposite. It's quite extremes. If you listen to that show, there's all sorts of things he's got, like carrying weights through the Highlands with a bagpiper behind him to give him inspiration, and 24 hours of crawling on his hands and knees to do a marathon underneath barbed wire. There's all sorts of crazy stuff. But using that context for leadership, there must have been times where that uncomfortable decision was taken and you got good results, and also you've bypassed that uncomfortable decision because it's, you didn't want to do it.
Yeah. And interestingly, when I, it's much easier to bypass those conversations when you're not comfortable about who you are as a person. So the more secure I felt and more I've understood who I am, the less likely I am to bypass those things now. That's just the way of it. But I guess actually one that was particularly formative was a conversation I had with Tony Roakes, and it's kind of come nicely circular because he ended up coming in and doing the Tokyo team as head coach. But when he was assistant coach with England, I was very much in the midst of trying to figure out this leadership thing and trying to work out how to do it. And I was finding it pretty challenging and, you know, it was like kind of close to tears at some points just because of the sort of frustration of it and not feeling like I was in a good place with it. And it was in Hong Kong, and I was trying to lead a sort of team meeting, and it was a goal-setting type meeting, and I'd not traditionally led them. It was normally the coach that had led it at that point in my career. And I was really struggling to kind of draw it to a close and kind of bring everyone together, and I just didn't really have the skill set at that time to do it. And Rocky, which was totally accurate intention and brilliant intention, was trying to help me. But the way it came across to me was that he sort of undermined me to some extent in that moment. And you met Rocky. He's quite a scary bloke.
Yeah, coach Rocky, yeah. Yeah, he is, he is.
But he's one of the nicest guys. Absolutely. With the best heart. But I couldn't click with him either at that stage. Like, he was relatively, I didn't understand him as a person. I didn't feel he understood me totally as a person at that stage. So it was the perfect scenario to not want to have the conversation with him afterwards and say, you know, look, I didn't like the way that meeting went at the end. That was mine to either mess up or get right. And I needed you to let me do that. Every fibre of my being was dissuading me from going and knocking on his hotel room door in Hong Kong and having that conversation with him. But I'm so glad I did, because, I mean, he was amazing in that moment. And that took our relationship as a player coach and as friends to a completely new level, one that I would never have thought possible with him, because I just didn't see that side of him, and I didn't think he saw that side of me. But it also just gave me that experience of like, you can just have that conversation, and normally actually some good comes out of it rather than, you know, the world's not going to crumble around me. And I was able to then, I mean, I took practical things from it as well, because I was gaining his perspective as someone who thinks differently, sees the world differently. Yeah, and it actually gave me a lot of confidence off the back of that. And that was a really sort of formative experience. I mean, it's one that, I don't know if I've ever really discussed it with Rocky since. I think I've mentioned it to him before, but it was probably just another conversation to him in a lot of ways. But for me, because of where I was at in my development, that was a really big moment. And the sort of personal challenge for me around some of these areas is I've grown up to develop a desire for things to work out, you know, perfectly, and for things to be absolutely bang on, which obviously serves you well to some extent when you want to succeed at stuff and you want to do well, but can cause problems as well if you don't manage that side of you. And I think with leadership challenges, I was so reluctant to make mistakes in a lot of scenarios because I felt those were bigger mistakes. I could be at peace with making a mistake on the field or a mistake that was going to affect me. Like, I didn't enjoy it, but I could be at peace with that. But I felt like leadership mistakes might impact the whole team, and that was a disaster if that was the case. And so a big thing I had to reinforce for myself was it's okay to make mistakes even in this space, which you're building up as being, you know, the be-all and end-all, but it's okay to make those errors. I don't know if you've had any experiences around the sort of pressure, I guess, that comes with being that leader of a group.
Absolutely, and I can think of countless examples, both where I've made mistakes and not admitted to them. And one of the previous shows in the first series was with, you know, one of your, you know, a former ex-England captain, Greg Barden, where, you know, we had exactly the same scenario that you talked about with Rocky, where Greg felt he needed to knock on my door and have an honest conversation, and my ego came out and I shut him down very quickly, and we repaired that relationship 12 years later. Mm. 12 years later.
Wow.
And so that's my journey as a coach till probably the last 5 or 6 or 7 years, where I see any opportunity to be honest around my failings as a chance to learn and a chance to gain trust with the team. So that's with Fiji, where I think I've talked about this before, where with Hong Kong, actually it was against England, we were first half 5-0 up, I think, or 5 points up against you. I think you're playing in this game, and we had a penalty in front of the posts, and I was screaming at them to take the 3 points. They ignored me. Two offloads later, try into the posts, and that, you know, put us 1 foot into the next round. And I had to stand up and apologise. It didn't go against our values that Oscar and the team had set, that, you know, we live by the sword, we die by the sword, the way we want to play. We don't suddenly change our behaviours because of one moment. And that was a good learning experience for me. And it bonded us, because you show vulnerability as a leader. It's important. You do it too many times, then you probably shouldn't be at the level you're at. But I think there's absolutely, I've seen some very, very good leaders that have stood up in front of young, experienced teams and told them that they've done something wrong. And it's lifted their esteem within the group, and it hasn't made anyone think that they're less able at the job they do.
Because I think if I, and I don't know if you'd agree, but if I wind the clock back a bit, I think my sense of a leader was one that had authority and almost, you know, could do no wrong. Like, that was, I think I was trying to project that a little bit, which you're making a rod for your own back, because you're always going to get things wrong.
Human beings, aren't
yeah,
we?
Yeah, exactly. And as someone who, before I was probably given the label of captain, was always very comfortable being vulnerable and probably quite comfortable owning up to mistakes, I beat myself up, but I wouldn't try and, if someone said or challenged me on something, then I think very often my reaction would be, yeah, I got that wrong, if I got that wrong. But all of a sudden that became more difficult with the leadership role for a while, because of this image I was probably trying to project and thought would garner respect from the boys, which was usually the opposite, isn't it? Usually you garner more trust and respect by being open and being honest and vulnerable.
As you can tell, Tom's got so many great views and opinions, and that's why we've decided to make this a two-parter, with that show coming up next week. In part two, we chat about making connections, values, belonging, relationships and life after rugby. One thing that struck me was the absence of one key moment we both experienced together, the Olympic final in Rio. That final was really pivotal for both of us and has shaped a lot of what we did subsequently, but neither of us mentioned it at all during our 2-hour perambulation. Not conscious, but perhaps tells you that the journey was what shapes us both, not the podium finishing position. We mentioned a few resources and links that we have made sure are in the show notes, and you can find those at benryan.co.uk/podcast. Tom can be found on social media at trmitchell on Instagram and at tbobbymitchell on Twitter, where you can follow him, contact him and see what he's up to. This is probably the bit that you stop listening to, as I tell you that leaving a review really helps us get more people listening to these shows. If you like it enough to spend some time doing that, then that's great and really appreciated. And so is just spreading the word through friends and family. You can find all the shows on the usual platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, TuneIn, Amazon Music, and Google Podcasts. This has been the Ben Ryan Podcast. Thanks for listening, and I look forward to bringing you another great chat next Wednesday.